Thank you.
So we're going to start this evening with just a couple of minutes of meditation. And then what I'd like to ask Susie is to turn up the lights a little bit, because it seems like, there you go.
Yay.
It seems there like that's the death part over there, and this is the life part.
Yeah. Oh, vice
and really, there's no separation. So now we can see your faces. Okay. Thank you. So if you could simply get yourself comfortable in your seats, sitting in an upright position if you can. And if it's comfortable for you, close your eyes. And if it's not comfortable with your eyes closed, keep them two-thirds closed. I will ring the bell three times to start the meditation and then two times to end it. And this is just an opportunity for us to really bring ourselves fully into the room, to be fully present, to hear each other with not only open ears, but with an open heart, to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, authentic, and most of all, present. So good evening, my name is Chodo, and I'm the co-founder of the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care, along with Koshin. We're here this evening to talk about the importance of really looking squarely in the face of, we like to think every day about old age, sickness, and death. It's not all we think about, but we like to take into account every day that this is part of our journey. This book that we are focusing on this evening came into being through not only the work that Koshin and myself do and have been doing for, in this iteration, for about 15 years, really taking our Buddhist practice off the cushion and into the world, to be of service in the world, but Not only from our point of view, but through working with our students and folks who were facing end of life and their families, and saying, why isn't there a book out there that talks about this stuff really openly? And so Koshin had this amazing idea of seeking out really the luminaries of this work. So the book is an anthology of teachers. We were just talking in the back room there that actually, even though Koshin and I are both Zen Buddhist teachers and monks, and the book is about awake and awakening, the authors are 85% Jewish. So a lot of Jew booze in the book. So I'm not going to speak too much because I think there's so many of us up here. So I'm going to just read a poem. And each of the speakers will also read a poem that speaks to them around this topic. And then they'll talk about their personal experiences. And then we'll have time for Q&A. So this book, this poem that I'm about to read is by Stanley Kunitz. It's called The Layers. Koshin and I actually read to Stanley on his 100th birthday, and he invited all his past students and friends to read to him on one afternoon, over a couple of days, I think. And the afternoon that Koshin and I went, you know, Stanley actually lived till he was 103, so he was 100 and full of life, actually, and sitting in his chair. And we said to him, "What would you like us to read?" And he said, "I want you to read from Moby Dick." So Koshin and I were reading from Moby Dick, reading from Moby Dick, reading from Moby Dick, for about 10, 15 minutes. And all of a sudden, Stanley said, "All right, I've always hated that book." He said, "But I thought, you know, 80 years later, it might say something to me. It doesn't. Let's have a cup of tea." So that was our last meeting with Stanley. This is one of my favorite poems of Stanley, so this is how I'm going to start the evening. And I wish I was standing up, because it's really weird to read a poem sitting down. For me to give, you know, the respect that poetry deserves, I think one should be standing, but here we are sitting. So this is called The Layers by Stanley Kunitz. I have walked through many lives, some of them my own, and I am not who I was, though some principle of being abides from which I struggle not to stray. When I look behind, as I am compelled to look before I gather the strength to proceed on my journey, I see the milestones dwindling toward the horizon and the slow fires trailing from the abandoned campsites over which scavenger angels wheel on heavy wings. Oh, I have made myself a tribe out of my true affections, and my tribe is scattered. How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses? In a rising wind, the manic dust of my friends, those who fell along the way, bitterly stings my face. Yet I turn, exulting somewhat with my will intact to go wherever I need to go, and every stone on the road precious to me. In my darkest night, when the moon was covered and I roamed through wreckage, a nimbus clouded voice directed me. Live in the layers, not on the litter. Though I lacked the art to decipher it, no doubt the next chapter in my book of transformations is already written. I am not done with my changes. Thank you.
So we're here tonight to be together. You know, my friends here were asking, like, what's our goal? And to me, it's really learning how to be together, which is, for some reason, the most challenging thing. Because we live in a time where people talk about how busy they are and they don't have enough time. And what I've learned in this work is that all we have is our time, and how we choose to spend our time, and how we are in the moments of our life. And for me, this is what I learn again and again from being with the dying, is that this is it. Chodo and I just came from Tucson, and where we're on the faculty of the medical school there, and working with these incredible physicians from around the country who are in the fellowship, and people talking about, well, I don't have time to contemplate. I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to do that. I'm busy, 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 busy. I agree. Because I think in many ways, like, how do we really inhabit where we are and not move away from where we are? And the work with the dying is, to me, just another wonderful reminder of it's just about showing up. You don't actually have to do much. And people tend to be very nervous about what to say, what to do, because we're not used to being in what's uncomfortable. And so to me, it's about learning how to be in fellowship in the discomfort, in the unknown. And so part of the reason this book exists is that we wanted to create a book that was a community of voices, not just one voice. There are many wonderful books, but this is a book of community where people are really talking about from their own personal experience of what it's like to imperfectly be at the bedside, to be imperfectly alive, and then the perfection of that, which to me is the greatest joy. So I'll read you a poem. And it's called The Gate by Marie Howe. I had no idea that the gate I would step through to finally enter this world would be the space my brother's body made. He was a little taller than me, a young man but grown, himself by then done at 28. Having folded every sheet, rinsed every glass he would ever rinse under the cold and running water. "This is what you've been waiting for," he used to say to me. And I'd say, "What?" And he'd say, "This." Holding up my cheese and mustard sandwich. And I'd say, "What?" And he'd say, "This," sort of looking around. So this poem reminds me so much of what my grandma taught me, that it's just these moments. And for me, learning from her about it just means showing up. And the pain that many people who went when she was dying, or even very sick, that people had such difficulty just showing up and looking at her. Many people showed up, but many people were so uncomfortable, like would sit, like not even get near her in the bed, would stay at the foot of the bed and would, you know, preoccupy themselves with adjusting things. So in many ways, the death of my grandmother was, you know, a new life for me. Losing one of the greatest loves of my life in the physical form. And the gift that she gave was to actually really live and not wait. So I'm delighted to be with you, and I can't wait to start for it to be more like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
What? So I'm here tonight because I'm so in love with Coach Koshin and Chodo. And I really wanted to be of support in whatever way I can. My husband died July 28th of 2015. And it was a long process of dying that I'm still learning what I need to learn from it. And I'm not so sure I could articulate what it is I'm learning. But I know I'm in a learning process. I think one of the things that's most poignant is the mystery of being alive, even equally with the mystery of death. We are all amateurs at it. I certainly feel like a total amateur at living. And yet the process of dying that I think I actually went through with my husband makes me feel somewhat professional at being completely uncertain. So it's there are so many ways of talking about it, so many aspects of intimacy and lack of intimacy, and the understanding in a room where someone's dying that the only what's left in terms after we've refined our lives into this moment of death feels just like pure love. And yet, at the same time, there is confusion and resistance and joy and deep sorrow. So it's not as if we can reduce it or bring it down to one thing. And perhaps that's the sum total of it is just this mystery of being alive in a human body. And that we can never definitively say what it's about, but that we can completely live it in every single moment. And that doing anything less is shortchanging the opportunity that we've been given to be in this human body for this life. My first teacher, when she was dying, said, "There's only love. There's nothing else." And that was many, many years ago. It was close to 30 years ago, I think. And that's been a koan for me. Is there really only love? Is there really only love? And what would that actually manifest? How would that manifest if that were really true? And if it's really true, is it actually manifesting? And if that is so, how do I embody it, participate in it, spread it, be it, express it? And so when Koshin asked that each of us read a poem, I chose this beautiful poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, called kindness. She says, before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Earlier this summer, I was in Jerusalem at an emergency room of a local hospital where my aunt Judy, my mother's sister at age 103, passed away. And I was asked by my mother to drive her to the hospital and be with her by her sister, who was surrounded by her children, who are very ultra-Orthodox, pious Jews. And in this emergency room, little curtained-off section, about a dozen of her children and grandchildren were standing holding poetry books and diligently chanting poetry. Poetry, of course, is the Psalms, the biblical book that is there for all occasions. And when you have nothing else to say, pretty much in the Jewish tradition, and believe it or not, there are times when we have nothing to say, then the Psalms is where you go to. And there's something, I'm listening to our poetry tonight and how we turn to the kindness of poetry when words fail us and when the mundane fails us. And I have to say, at that night, there was something unkind about the the OCD-ness of just, we have to say the Psalms, we have to say the font. And I said to my mother, I said, do you want some time alone with Judy? Away from all this religious chatter and mumbling of words? And she said, yes, that would be kind. And so I had the chutzpah, the courage to go to my cousins and say, do you mind giving just a couple of minutes she wants to be alone in silence with Auntie Judy? And it wasn't an easy negotiation, but and she passed away just shortly after. So I'm thinking about poetry tonight, which I wasn't thinking that I'll be feeling or thinking about, and where it comes in our lives, not just in the thresholds of mortality, but in all the tangible moments of needing to touch something where the mundane won't do. And I want to share a poem from the book that I looked at earlier. And what jumped at me in this poem that I'll share with you is that it's talking about love letters. And we are at this moment on the Jewish calendar, at least, which is preparing us to die. The Day of Atonement, which is 20 days from tonight, is the annual opportunity to reimagine our own death and the deaths of our loved ones. And it's a day in which we rehearse our death. We are in white, as if in shrouds. We are barefoot. We are fasting. The liturgies are full of poetry, of considering our mortality. And a lot of it is guilt and angst, but peel that away, and inside is kindness and awareness of presence. So I have this practice now for 7 years that I write a daily reflection on the 40 days leading into the Day of Atonement, and we're on day 20, and this year I'm writing love letters to elements of the world and my life. And so the convergence of us talking about when we are there with the deaths of our loved ones, and what does it mean for us to do the work of being in the moment of aliveness at this time of year? I think there's a really beautiful Jubu convergence here that's inviting us to be reflective. So if I may borrow your copy. Thank you. This is a poem that's called Love After Love by Derek Walcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, "Sit here, eat." You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. So beautiful. I just feel like sitting with this. So yummy. It's like, who would have imagined we come to talk about death? And it's, as our tradition says, tov me'od, it's good. It's good to face what is true, what's here. So I love that we have the JCC and we have the JBCC, that it's the Jewish Buddhist Community Center. And I was half kidding about the Om and the Mu, because when you spoke about my journey, I spent many years studying with Dido Lurie and with Miyotai, Mbani Miyotai Tracy, and many years as an ultra-Orthodox crazy Jew. And I think one of the profound gathas that I learned, one of the great prayers was, and we were talking about this chodo, about the evening gatha of do not squander your life. Wake up, wake up. And the time that Amichai, I love that you said Amichai. It says he is a chai. He's like that. That's what he is.
One of my favorite drinks.
It's the best. He, you know, when he's speaking about these love letters during this time of the year, this waking up time of the year, what it is to be awake. And the profound
nature of that question of what it is to live an awakened life, and how an awakened life, how we have to use the temerity and the profound tenuousness of this thing that tethers us moment by moment to the great mystery that you spoke of so beautifully, Gina, the great mystery of being not only confronting the great abyss of the unknown, but the great abyss of the unknown here, now, this grilled cheese, this cheese and mustard sandwich, this gate that we walk through at every moment. And I think that for me personally, as I've always been obsessed with death. I say that, but it didn't really hit home until I had children. And I was just reading in the latest book by Jonathan Safran Foer. I'm only a little bit through the tome of 500 and something pages, but in the beginning he has a profound moment where he says, you know, none of us knows, none of us is prepared or is warned that this will be the last time that our parents will read us a bedtime story, or that this will be the last time that we say goodbye, or this will be the last time, right, that our friend will leave a message for us. We don't know those things. Those are the great unknowns that we live with, and in some ways we avoid knowing, because to know that would be scary. Mm-hmm. So there I am this morning, sitting and trying to read so much of this. I mean, it's not hard to read this, right? It's just so nourishing to read this book. And I'm sitting there in a Starbucks and I'm reading, and a colleague walks in, and she works here at the JCC. And she looks over my shoulder and she says out loud, I wonder who's reading Awake at the Bedside. And I said, hi. She said, oh, you're getting ready for tonight. I said, yeah. She said, started talking about the book. And then she said, I just had the most harrowing experience, the nightmare of every parent. And I said, what happened? She said, I was standing on a platform waiting for a train. And next to me was a woman with probably a four-year-old and a two-year-old daughters. And as the train approached, right, the train doors opened, and the four-year-old ran into the train, and the doors closed. And the woman was left on the platform with her two-year-old. And they began to scream. The woman began to scream, and then the two-year-old started to scream. And my friend, his rabbi, she... the doors opened again, you know, the way the subway doors open quickly. And she stuck her hands in the door. And she refused to let them close again. And she just was holding. She said, I was holding. And she showed me her hands with the black. And then finally the doors opened and there was this reunion. And I was I was so moved by that. That image of the doors closing. And I couldn't stop thinking about it all day, about that being a metaphor for life. Not knowing when the doors will close and when the things that we have to say goodbye to will be on the other side of a gate that we can't cross. And how unexpected it arrives. And so the Talmud says, Le'olam yaseh adam tshuva, Yom Echad Lifnei Moto, that a person should always return and get their things in order one day before they die. And like any good Jewish text, the question of the question says, well, how does one know the day before they're going to die? And so the Talmud answers, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Any day. Any platform. Any moment, we hang and we wait. And the question I think that your profound, profound work raises for all of us is practice for the unexpected. Prepare for that which you can't prepare for. Turn now, because now. So I chose one of my favorite poems, even though some who know Farsi don't like Coleman Barks. I love Coleman Barks, and I love what he does to Rumi. Mm. And in his poem, guest house roomie the great koan, the great mystery, the great riddle of existence is homecoming and belonging, and how we can be at home in this guest house that we live in. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whomever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond.
Is this a good time to get some questions from the audience?
Sure. Have a conversation.
A conversation. Let's have a conversation. I love talking. Yes. And do us a favor. Just tell us your name.
My name is Susan, and I have three quick comments. One is the reaction to all there is love. I think we're born with fear, and I think we learn to love. And I think all during our lives we are dealing with the fear and the love. And I think what's going on in this country and in the world, in terms of terrorism and reaction to quote-unquote terrorism, is fear. I mean, I almost feel like crying now because it's so heavy on all of us right now, but dealing with fear and feeling and trying to find what that basis, what is that fear? So that's one comment. The second is that I recently wrote an essay about finding my Judaism in Morocco, in a Muslim country. And the spiritualism I felt, this was in the countryside, of seeing people praying in their own individual way, one-on-one, with a prayer rug, and meeting whatever their higher being was, and that communication. And you rarely experience that in cities in here. And then the third comment was, I did not watch my mother die at her bedside. She died slowly of Alzheimer's. And so I had the unique experience of loss, experiencing loss over time. But as a reaction to what you were saying, that you're still learning, I watched her become a child and a baby and an infant, and then she died. And that's what I remember. There was a lot of joy, incredible joy, because all the other stuff, the fears and whatever, went away. And what was left was her joy. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Someone else can make a comment?
Can I just make a comment about what Susan
sure,
said?
Sure, sure, sure.
I'm so happy that you paired fear and love, because, you know, a lot of the time we think that the opposite of love is hate, and actually fear is the opposite of love, and love is the opposite of fear. So thank you for saying that.
Hello. My name is Neil Confer, And this whole conversation raises some deep fears of myself, and I'd like to hear some response to it. My fear is that as I get older, I could very well end up suffering for a fair amount of time before I die, or I might be at the bedside of someone else who's suffering, and they try to alleviate these with medical help. But I'd like to hear, how does one deal with that kind of suffering and pain of an illness or approaching death? I hope I'm being clear.
Depends. Definitely depends. There's not one. I can tell you a story. So when I was training, it was probably one of the most important moments of my life. I was training as a clinician, and I was on call, and what brought into the emergency room at 3 a.m. And behind the curtain was like a little fern of a man, curled up like a fern. And it seemed like the wife and 5 daughters pressed against the curtain, and the man was there in the bed about 6 feet away. And I said, "So what's happening?" And they said, "We don't know." But he was moaning in the bed. And I said, "Well, what do you know what he's saying?" And they said, "No." And clearly he was suffering. And it was actually clear to me that he was also dying. So I went over. Well, actually, I first asked them, "Is it like, do you know what he's saying?" And they said, "No." I said, "Would you like to find out?" And they said, "That's why you're here." And so in talking about fear, the fear in that curtained off room was so powerful. And when I went over to his bed and just kind of put my ear to his mouth as he was groaning, he was saying the same thing again and again and again, as many people do when they're suffering, as we do. And what he was saying again and again still moves me to this day. And what he was saying is, "Please hold me. Please hold me. Please hold me." And so I went back to the daughters and the wife, and I said, "You know, he wants to be held." And I said, "We don't do that." Mm-hmm. "That's why you're here. Mm-hmm. You do that." So I ended up, you know, holding him. And he would just start to say, "More, more, more, more." And eventually I actually got into the bed with him and cradled him. And he died. And that's just, in talking about love and fear, to me, the willingness to put our ear to what's happening without having to know anything, without having to have the answers, to me it's like being willing to be totally afraid yourself, myself. To me, that's part of the training, is to really learn how to be with my own fear and discomfort and my own pressed up against the wallness, that I have that in me too. and that there was no one to blame. But to me, it was also such a powerful teaching of what are we waiting for? In our relationships now, right now, today, are we loving as much as we can? Now. You know, it's like exactly today, now, are you loving as well as you can? Mm-hmm. To me, that's what I'm thinking about. Thank you.
So, Neil, thank you for your question. There are a couple of things I heard you ask, and one of them was about the physical suffering. And, you know, such an important thing that some of us don't realize is that we don't have to die in pain. You know, the book actually talks a lot about this, the palliative care movement, which is really taking hold now in our culture. So many people think that palliative care is actually only available for people as they're approaching the end of their life, but palliative care is available at all times for anyone who is suffering physically in pain. So to answer one of your questions is that we don't have to fear dying in pain, because there is so much that can be done to alleviate the physical pain. And the other question was, how would you be with someone who's dying? How do you do that? And as Koshin talked about, we don't have to do anything. Simply being present to another when they're dying is usually all we have to do. Because, you know what, we know how to die. We've been doing it for hundreds of thousands of years. We know how to do this. We actually don't need help. What we need is someone, usually, in Koshin's beautiful story, usually someone that loves us to companion us, to just be there. I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've sat with someone who's dying, and they've wanted nothing but just to have someone in the room. In our culture, unfortunately, so many people die alone.
Who don't want to.
Rabbi Ingbe was mentioning earlier, reminding us about George Bell. George Bell, you know, made the New York Times, died alone in his apartment. For how long was he there? 3 weeks, something like that? Mm-hmm. In New York City. It's a shanda. Is that the right word? The shanda.
Shanda.
In New York City, a Buddhist monk sings shanda.
Yeah.
And he said Megillah earlier. He said it, the whole Megillah. I thought, who are you?
Thank you, Neil. Thank you. Good to see you.
Hello. Hi, my name is Samantha. I'm a social worker in a hospital in New York City. And I find that often there's a conflict between what the doctors want and what the patients want. Because essentially when a patient dies, unless you are part of the hospice palliative team, then you're a failure to that doctor. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many people I know where the social workers are all saying they're going to die, and the doctors just give them hope and more treatments and more chemo and more. And it's very difficult to be in conflict with that part of the care team when you want to at least be available for the conversations of their lives. Mm-hmm. And this new stage of their life, when there's conflicting information and ideas. I do think having an advocate is a huge thing, and too many people die alone without advocates because it's a really hard time in your life to advocate for yourself. It's really hard to watch so many people not be able to. A lot of people need a presence, but also just a guide, you know, to say it's okay to say these things, ask these things, or not say anything. Personally and professionally, I find that very challenging.
You know, a large piece of the work that we do at our center is, apart from meditation, of course, and study, as Koshi mentioned, we're on the faculty of a couple of medical institutions, and it's our vision, our journey, to educate clinicians. We just returned from Tucson this morning, 4 o'clock this morning, where we were with 80 integrative medicine fellows who have all gone through medical school, and not once did they have on the curriculum how to be with the dying. And this is generally doctors across the board. Mm. So our work here in New York City and Tucson and Texas, all over the country, is to sit with doctors and have them model what it's like to be really in relationship with a person. Mm. They're petrified. We gave a talk at the Integrative Medicine Symposium about 5 years ago at the Hilton. There were like 1,000 doctors in the room, right? And we asked them to turn to face each other. And it was unbelievable. I mean, talk about palpable fear. Mm. So the part of our work is to train physicians to point out, if you can't sit next in front of this person who you've been training with all in residence with all week in this integrative fellowship, how do you think you're going to sit in front of a patient? Mm-hmm. If you've never done this with your husband or your spouse, how are you going to do it with the patient? You know, it's so incredible that perhaps most of us in this room have never really spent time making eye contact with the person in front of us. It's so uncomfortable, and yet it's so important that we're able to do that.
I'm sorry, I got you off.
One other thing quickly is that we all have the right as patients to say no to the doctor. Mm. When the doctor says, "I think we need, if we did this, if we did that," we all, you know, we live in this culture and we're raised that doctors are the experts. Mm-hmm. You know, they're fumbling around just as much as we are. Mm-hmm. And we can always say no, or what's the alternative? And the doctor might say, "You're going to die." Okay, how will I do that? You know?
Yeah, and I also wanted to add that that we were discussing in the back of the parallels between, you know, birthing and the business of birth and the business of death, and how in both of these industries, as it were, that the deep wisdom that you just offered, that we know how to die and that we've been doing it for a long time, and the same thing in terms of trusting women, being able to trust their own bodies and being able to utilize some of the advances in medicine, but also not to have that obfuscate the deep wisdom that they have, and that that doctors by definition are not trained for, unfortunately, to offer no answer. So when they don't have one, they don't know what is desired of them, and so no presence, compassion, love. Well, that's not, you don't become a chief love officer, you become a doctor, right? So I went to, but the tension is palpable, because when I'll just give you a story. I think it was a month ago. I just come back with my family from vacation, and I got a call that I had to run immediately to Sloan Kettering, that a woman in our community's father had gone into septic shock. And when we arrived in the ICU, essentially he was unresponsive, and there was really no chance medically that he was going to be, that he would pull through. And they were somewhat religious, and so at least she wasn't, but the family was, and they were reciting the poetry of always, you know, of every occasion, the Psalms. And there was a moment for me as a caregiver and as a rabbi and a spiritual, I guess as a doula, as a death doula in a way, of how to both keep hope alive, which is essentially what they were saying. They're saying, we're praying for a miracle, and not losing an opportunity to actually to die well with your father, your brother, and how to be realistic for the sake of being real with what's happening, that you know that you can be with it, mm-hmm. and say goodbyes and pray for safe passage or meditate for safe passage or whatever it might be, and how to hold that tension, that balance, because they really were hoping. And so I was saying, you know, I said, I really feel like we need to make preparations here. Maybe each person should be alone with him and so on and say goodbye. And they wanted to keep praying. They wanted to keep praying. And there was no way. And the doctors were confused. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to be. So a lot of this training for doctors and training and invitations for them to have another access point or another way of being with people is so important to not lose that precious opportunity to say goodbye appropriately or to give them that gift, that last gift.
Someone else over here?
Hi, Mary Remington.
My name is Joan, and I'm glad that I'm speaking here after your last comments about the doctors. I have lost both of my parents. One didn't die the way he wanted. My father didn't die the way he wanted. My mother kept bringing him back to life and not letting him go. And on the other hand, and they wouldn't leave me alone with him because they knew that I would kind of probably, I was ready to be with him in those final moments. Nobody let me be alone with him. My mother didn't want to know she was dying, and the doctor didn't tell her because I think he knew her well enough and knew that she didn't want to know, but he told me. And again, my siblings didn't want to let her go. They didn't want to bring hospice in. And it was so painful. So I guess what I'm saying is when there's a conflict within the family and also within the patient, whether they want to know or not, how do you deal with that? Or is there no way to work with such a scenario? Thank you.
Well, I served on the medical ethics team for about 10 years, and I would say 95% of the ethics cases were like the one you're talking about. And it's really about that people don't know how to talk to each other in terms of actually really giving and really receiving. So for me, it's actually about generosity. And to me, how do you just slow it down enough to say, like, wow, we are not talking about the same things. Hmm. We're using words that may sound similar, but we're not even talking the same language. So how do you just slow it down so that you can really receive and really hear? And I think it's also so embedded in our culture, in particular in this country, where, you know, the word is, do you want to sign a do not resuscitate order which makes people feel like I'm killing this person. Where in England, it's called AND, allow a natural death. And so who wouldn't want to allow a natural death? Well, maybe some of us would have challenges around that. But it's very different, even in terms of language. So to me, it's about, but to me, the key is giving and receiving, learning how to hear each other. And it's often a conflict of the doctors or the medical team doesn't, they don't really know how to talk to the family and really hear what's happening and what's needed. Yeah. Thank you. Mother?
Good evening. My name is Richard Chusid. I just would like to tell us a little story, and then if you have reactions, fine. If not, that's okay, too. It's about my father. He was quite sick, and my brother and I knew he was dying. And we were alternating going out to St. Louis to see him, and I was at his bedside. And I said to him, if you would like to stop treatment, that's fine with Tom and with me. Just let us know what you want us to do. And a few days later, he said, yeah, I think I'm ready. And I said, okay, is there anything you want us to do? And he said, I have only two requests, that you take care of thirst and that someone be with me 24/7. And I said, okay. So my brother and I alternated the time. And then I asked him, probably out of naivete, about not knowing what else to do, I said, are you afraid? And he said, no. I'm really intrigued by what the experience will be like. Mm. So he taught me how to live his final days.
So I just want to say, Richard, you know, I know you, and I just want to share that my Rebbe, Reb Zalman, this story is told over in the book by Sarah Davidson called The December Project, but Reb Zalman himself told the story that he, in the last couple of years, he wanted to really raise awareness around conscious dying and what it might be to be awake at your own bedside. And there's a story in there that in the Jewish tradition, after a person passes, there's actually a ritual washing of the body that's called Tahara. And so Reb Zalman contacted my friend Mark Soloway, who was the rabbi in Boulder, and with two other people, Reb Zalman showed up at Mark's house one day in the last year of his life. And in the backyard in Boulder, there was a massage table. And Reb Zalman was wearing a bathing suit. And he got onto the massage table and he told them, I want you all to wash me as if I was already passed. Mm. Because I want to know what it'll feel like. Mm. I want to imagine what it will be when I pass. And that was, you know, his walking in, trying to be as awake as possible and to be as curious as possible about what might terrify a lot of us. He wanted to really... So I love that your father taught you that. That's great. Well,
it's so beautiful.
I have a story about conscious dying, too. Actually, in the book, there's a whole bunch of photographs from a piece that the New York Times did on one of the most important people in my life for 25 years. So actually, Koshin and I were with him for the last 4 years as he was slowly dying. And, you know, just I don't want to go too much into our medical system, but we went in through four years, we went through $85,000 of his money for 24/7 care. We had to sell his home in Sag Harbor and then moving out of his apartment into assisted living. And so it was about towards the end of the fourth year of going through my inheritance, all his money. So we were about to run out of money. It was in a fairly nice assisted living, and I said to him, John, we have about 2 or 3 months left, and then there's no insurance, there's no money to pay for this, you're going to have to go into a nursing home. And he said, I can't do that. you know, like the thought of going into a nursing home, I can't do that. So he said, I just want to be here for Thanksgiving and Christmas. He would have been, it's his birthday on the 26th of December, and then we'll revisit it. So I said, well, you know, the last rent check will go out on January 31st, and then we have to look for a nursing home. I said, okay. So he got through Thanksgiving, he got through Christmas, he got through New Year's. We spent all those holidays with him, all those holiday evenings and days with him. We were visiting, I was visiting him every single morning and every single night for pretty much 3 years on my way to the center and back. And on the 9th of January, he was my sponsor in the 12-step program. On the 9th of January, I was taking someone into rehab that morning, and that was the moment he chose to die. I mean, he was conscious of the fact that he was not going to go into a nursing home. And he said, I just want to get through the holidays, and then I'll go. And he died beautifully. You know, it's like, it's very beautiful. And he obviously didn't want to die when I was there, because I had been with him every single day for 3 years. So, yeah. Someone in the front here?
Yeah, maybe one more question. Hi. My name's Sharon. Thank you so much for being here. Take care of my dad, who, it feels weird to have this microphone, but I'm going to get used to it, who is 101 years old. And I moved back to New York a few years ago to take care of him in his declining years. And these last 6 months, I've had to get 24/7 care for him because it's been physically and emotionally too much for me to do on my own. I can't lift him from his bed. He's not able to stand anymore. He's in diapers. And he's beginning to lose it mentally a little bit, not a little bit, but in and out. He's gets into the sort of liminal state. And we too are running out of money. And my sister, who lives in Colorado, wants him to move out to Boulder to be in a nursing home because it might just be, you know, Medicaid would cover all that and all that stuff. And my feeling about it is to keep him home as much as possible. I mean, he's willing to go, but my gut level is for him to stay. And it's a very, very tough thing because it's hard on me. I mean, like, I try to be there and present and loving and the whole thing, but honestly, I have a lot of very mixed emotions about this. I mean, I feel a lot of... I feel the gamut. I feel resentment. I feel frustration. I feel disgust. I mean, the other night I had him come to dinner and he sat with us and he was having a bowel movement in the middle of the meal and I felt terrible, but I had to leave. I couldn't finish my dinner and be with him. And so there's this constant like this guilt that I feel of like, you know, wanting to love him and be with him. And he's also not always very nice to me. He can be very mean and nasty. When he gets into these states where he's, like today and last night, he was just talking about all kinds of things. I try to engage him to find out where his mind is and if there are threads that I can kind of relate to. And the aides are kind of like, oh, he's just, you know, that's just the way they are. They're just losing it. They're not making any sense. And I don't want to hear about the they, you know. I don't care what classes they took. I think that there is, even though it may sound confused, I think there's meaning to what he's saying, and I want to get to what he's saying, and I want to listen to him. And it's hard to, you know, to be with a staff that's just kind of dismissing it as like, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. They're just, you know, losing it. So I guess I'm asking for advice, and I've already heard quite a bit tonight, mostly advice about how to deal with my own mixed feelings and my guilt about that.
Maybe Gina will be able to respond to that. I'm not sure if you would like to, Gina.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it? And confusing. And scary. And can you start there? So death isn't always a romantic, kind of pretty process. My husband died of prostate cancer. And it's not a pretty disease. And yet, until the very last day of his life, he was lying there. Whatever the body processes were, whatever beauty or ugliness was there, it was him. And none of my romantic ideas about how the death should happen were necessarily going to come true. And that's hard to face. It's really hard to face. So can you just start with some compassion for the one who wants it to be a certain way? We want it to be a certain way. We can't help it sometimes. And yet, a lot of the time, life just doesn't cooperate, you know? It's really uncooperative. And yet the love is there. You clearly have a lot of love for your dad. And can you really be in both? In the love for him just as he is, and all of the mess of your wanting it to be some other way. You're not even sure what that other way would be. Yeah. And that confusion. And all, so you're in the midst of a most beautiful process. But it may look ugly to you. And can you be with both be in both places, have a foot in the place that's the really beautiful process and the place where it really feels ugly and looks ugly and is nowhere near what you thought it would be like for your dad to die? Or even, maybe he's not even dying, maybe he's just going through this place of deep illness and where the body breaks down. Everything changes, everything dies. We're dying as we all sit here. But, you know, we pretty it up and we put lipstick on it and it all looks really great. But we're all dying. It's just, what are you going to do, you know?
You're gonna die.
And he's gonna die. And can you really feel what you need and what he needs in all of the disgust and the resistance? Can you break through to just being there with him? Bowel movements and all. It's okay.
So I think we'll end with the evening gatha, if that's okay.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. And then we hope you'll stay with us afterwards, meet each other, talk with the presenters.
So this gatha is a chant that we chant in Zen Buddhist temples every night. So all the Zen temples across the world, it's called the Evening Gatha. And I had the honor, Koshin and I had the honor of doing this for Amichai, I think, last Yom Kippur, maybe?
And,
and it was a really moving, to do it in a place, to do it over the high holidays for a Jewish huge audience was really amazing feeling. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. On this night, the days of our life are decreased by one. Each of us should strive to awaken, awaken, take heed. Do not squander your life.
Thank you so much, and thank you, dear friends.
Thank you.
Friends.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.